And now, coming to you live from the Waldorf Room, high atop the legendary Coot Street Motel 6, it's the Coot Street Podcast with Gary K. Wolfe and Jonathan Strahan.
You actually did that, didn't you?
I did.
You actually went ahead and did it. Okay.
At least once I had to do it, right?
We might as well. I mean, after 100, we figure we have no responsibility to anyone.
Well, isn't that what happens when you get to when you've been 100, you've got your letter. If you're in the UK, you got the letter from the Queen. Probably, You know, it used to be, I think, in the States, you'd end up, you know, you could get your name on the morning show with Willard Scott or whatever it is. It was Mr. Gary Cable from, you know, sort of Columbus, Ohio, turned 100 today.
Those are people who are 100 years old, not people who've done the same thing 100 times.
But surely we can begin to lose all semblance of reason now that we've passed 100.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. People think we were rambling before.
and we have to, readdress our theme song. You know, perhaps, you know, sort of ramble on will become the official theme of the Coot Street Podcast.
We could certainly do that, and it's very appropriate.
And I'll have to adjust the logo to make the little alien look a lot older.
I could get sensitive about that after a while, but not yet.
Hey, look, I was talking with some people yesterday. I was in a meeting, and they were saying, you know, everybody was over 40, certainly, and some were over 50, and a few over 60. And we're not old. And I'm saying, well, I have a staff who work for me at my day job, and all of them are pretty much, bar one, at like 10 years younger than me or more. And they turn around and say, you tell dad jokes. Like, I'm stuck in the dad role anyway. Yes, we're older. We just have to try and find the good part of that.
That's true. And part of it is I think I've been told, at least, that you gain some perspective. Not a lot. Or maybe not that you gain a perspective, that you have a perspective which is different, but not necessarily better than that of anyone else. One of the things that comes up, and we've talked about it more often than we probably should, is what's it like to begin reading science fiction in the 50s or 60s or 70s or 80s or 90s? And I don't think I don't want to join the chorus of geezers saying, well, if you didn't start reading the pulp magazines before they folded in 1954, you don't know science fiction. I don't think that starting reading in the 50s privileges you over somebody who started reading in the 90s, which is why we.
But see,
need
that was. No. Old fart alert comment.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Old, you know, you privilege someone who's reading in the 50s, who started in the 50s over the 90s. They started reading in the 2010s, Gary. You know, it's like it's already 2012. You know, that's how we can turn around and have.
People started reading science fiction in the 2010s don't even have their science fiction driver's license yet. They're still reading on a learner's permit.
Now, this is an inclusive modern world. Those young
can't
folk
read
are...
science fiction without a licensed driver in the seat next to you. That's what I say.
But hang on, isn't one of the problems that we've been complaining about that people write science fiction as though that were the case?
I think that is a problem, yes.
You know, so this sort of thing is like we are jesting, we are joking, but you know, we need to be sure we're validating the opinions of people, or acknowledging and considering, perhaps better than validating, acknowledging and considering the opinions of people who are just entering the field and experiencing science fiction anew, or have been reading for a shorter period of time. I mean, if you've been reading science fiction for 5 or 10 years, your opinion is every bit as valid as someone who's been reading it for 30. I mean, I suspect Charles would sort of disagree, but that was his
thing. Well, I mean, you know. Yeah, and there are a lot of people of his generation who might agree with that. But my point is, I think there's a lot to be learned from people who start reading in different periods, with one exception, one sort of caveat to that. Because when I talk to people who've begun reading science fiction, even young people and students I have who might have begun reading science fiction in the last 5 or 10 years, that doesn't mean they've begun reading science fiction of the last 5 or 10 years.
Well, that's true. That's very true. It's interesting to see
where still have people entering science. Yeah, their first science fiction novel, for good or ill, there are a lot of people out there, young people, whose introduction to science fiction was Ender's Game.
Oh, sure. I mean, being introduced to the science fiction field by something 20 years your predecessor or 30 years your predecessor is probably about, or feels to me roughly, the kind of the normal generational thing. I mean, when I encountered science fiction, it was what, 1972, and the stuff that I'd encountered had been written in the mid 50s. So for somebody to encounter science fiction now in 2012, if it's from the late 80s, early 90s, that doesn't feel completely too far off. And Ender's Game, I mean, I know the story was 1977, but the book was 85. So, you know, for a mid-80s book, yeah. I mean, the only odd thing is, I had this conversation with Marianne last week about who are the most influential science fiction writers of the 20th century and who would you have picked? And we sort of had a little chat about it because they're showing a documentary series here in Australia on SBS called, was it Prophets of Science Fiction? It was hosted by Ridley Scott.
That's a Ridley Scott thing. I've seen many of those. And yeah. It's an odd series.
It's very, very odd. But they started off with Philip K. Dick, yeah? And I think it's fair to say that Philip K. Dick is the most influential science fiction writer of the 20th century.
Who? Depends on where the influence is.
World at large. Outward-focused rather than inward-focused.
I would agree with that in the sense that the cultural expressions that derive from Philip K. Dick's vision are probably more evident in movies and TV programs and just general free-floating paranoia than that of any other writer.
Yeah.
That's a worldview which is which was not very influential at the time at all.
I mean, this is my point to Marianne was, nobody would have picked. I mean, if you had sat down in 1980, 2 years before he died, 2 years before Blade Runner, and if you'd sat every science fiction reader in the Western world down and asked them to write a list of the top 10 most likely to be influential for the next 30 years science fiction writers, I bet no one would have listed Philip K. Dick.
Or a few people with very eccentric tastes might have.
Maybe.
But by and large, at the time he was, a paperback writer, essentially.
And this grew directly out of our conversation last week about the Dean of Science Fiction. And I was talking to Marianne about it after the podcast. Because she was sort of saying, who would you pick for the, 2012? And whilst my honest answer is nobody, because I don't think it's relevant, that's what we said last week, the closest I could come to would be Le Guin. Now.
Yeah.
She probably has been I take out the caveat. She's been enormously influential. There's no doubt about that. I don't know if she's been influential the way Philip K. Dick has been. Probably the most influential science fiction writers in that sense would be Dick, Bill Gibson, somebody else?
If you're talking about moving outside of the science fiction group, Neal Stephenson could be moving into that group. I mean, if you're talking about culture-wide influences, people affected. The thing you can, the test for Philip K. Dick is that a lot of people have picked up on Philip K. Dick ideas through movies or through osmosis or TV programs who don't even, have never read a word of Philip K. Dick.
Yes.
I think the same thing's true with Bill Gibson's Cyberspace, and I think increasingly it may be getting true of some of Neal Stephenson. I'm speaking specifically of Snow Crash, which is in the same area. I think you're right. In the 1950s or 60s, or probably up until the 70s, people would just have easily said, clearly the most influential writer is Heinlein, because Heinlein was influential among other science fiction writers.
Yes, exactly.
But his influence in the culture at large was, and even during his lifetime, was never nearly what he wanted it to be.
Yes. And this is one of those things as well. I mean, obviously, that when you're influential is really, really interesting and important. I mean, I think Joanna Russ is a great example because she was obviously quite influential at a certain period in her life and is very influential again now, and probably more influential now, arguably, from what I can tell, than she was during her lifetime.
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know that I'd agree with that. I mean, she's certainly having a broader cultural impact now. I think what she did during her lifetime, which was time-bound, was give a lot of younger writers, not just female writers, but largely female writers, but not exclusively, freedom to talk about things in a way, in a voice, in a very in some ways politicized, very angry, very honest voice that they hadn't talked about before. And what she was doing was something that, to a large extent, the New Wave and Harlan Ellison's Dangerous Visions failed to do, which was actually to liberate those younger voices. So I think that, you know, her impact in the 70s and 80s was something we haven't even fully measured yet.
Okay.
I agree she's having another kind of influence today, but I think that it's, from my mind, it's difficult to overestimate what she must have done to young writers reading The Female Man, or even Picnic in Paradise, or The Two of Us, or whatever.
Okay, let me take this from a different side, because we didn't specifically do this last week, and I think it's probably a valid and a valuable thing to discuss. Mm-hmm. Who are the most influential female science fiction writers of the last 110 years?
Well, if you're keeping it to 110 years, you're leaving out Mary Shelley, who's...
I am. I'm talking... But see, that's a little too pat. I mean, she's relevant and everything else, but I want to talk about, focus like on the modern era of science fiction, because this is the era that's arguably the most problematic as well, you know, or is highly problematic, whether it's most or not. And so it's worth saying, well, okay, I can think of names. I can think of people who are important, people who did great work. Who are the most influential? I mean, there are three or four that come to mind, but I'm curious to what your assessment is now.
Well, we've already talked about Russ, and we've already talked about Le Guin. And by the way, just a parenthetical thing I meant to say a few minutes ago when you were talking about her as the dean of science fiction. Coming from a university, knowing a university structure, having actually been a dean. My reaction to that question, I think last week I might have said Joe Haldeman is the dean of science fiction. That's because I can only think of Ursula as the president of science fiction. In the hierarchy of the university, she is really on a level, I think, apart from any other living writers, possibly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she obviously is got to be on that list. I think that, when you talk about influence, we've got her and we've got Russ. And then we've got some writers that you may not think about, but that I suspect have had really lasting influences. Not in a highbrow literary way, but in a cultural way and in a reader and writer kind of way. One of those is Andre Norton.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people. I don't know how much of Andre Norton is in print. Obviously, the Witch World series became much more familiar to most readers than her early science fiction novels did. But I don't think anybody claims terrible literary complexity and sophistication for her. She wasn't trying for that. But she really inducted a lot of new readers into science fiction. And I think once a lot of young women writers discovered that she had been doing that and make a good living at it, almost created, after Heinlein, almost created the young adult market for fantasy and science fiction. Between Heinlein and now, you had Madeline L'Engle, you had Andre Norton, John Christopher, possibly in England. But to some extent, there's a long period of a few decades there in young adult literature where you have to bridge between Heinlein and The Hunger Games.
Yeah.
And Andre Norton was crucial in that group.
Yeah.
I myself, if you want to name personal favorites, I thought that C.L. Moore was a terrific writer. Influential, it's hard to separate out what she did from Henry Kuttner. Lee Brackett. If you want to talk about a writer whose influence reached throughout the culture in all sorts of ways, even though it wasn't necessarily based on her science fiction works, you could make an argument that Lee Brackett actually has had as wide a cultural impact as anybody, writing Howard Hawks Westerns and writing Raymond Chandler Mysteries and writing a very good science fiction novel in the 50s and writing pulp science fiction. I think one of the problems with somebody like Brackett is that she did so many different things and did them well that she's not remembered for any one of them in particular.
What about Judy Merrill or Kate Wilhelm or somebody like that?
I don't think Judy Merrill was, to be honest, as a fiction writer, I don't think she was ever that good. I think she was a terrific editor, and I think her editorial skills were enormously influential. And if we want to talk about that, we have to talk about Judy Lynn Del Rey as well.
But also Betty Ballantyne, surely.
Well, Betty Ballantyne, and my argument, and I've probably made this before, my argument for the editor who probably did more to introduce the New Wave into the United States than Judy Merrill was C.L. Goldsmith, who was editing Amazing and Fantastic.
Yeah.
and buying very early stories from Gene Wolfe and Ursula Le Guin and J.G. Ballard and Samuel Delaney and so forth.
Okay, let me ask you another weird question to mm-hmm. interject. How about this as an idea? Women editors have been at least as influential on the field as women writers, if not more so.
Well, that is a little bit of a loaded question. because why would you preface that with women? If you want to make the proposition that editors have arguably been as influential on the field as writers have, that seems fairly obvious. So if it's obvious in general, why would it not be obvious for women as well?
I wonder if it's because and I don't know this to be true or not, it might have been somewhat easier to actually get into a employment hierarchy as an editor than it was to get out and promote your name as a writer, perhaps. And it's just that, I mean, I look down, I not only think of, you know, Celia Goldsmith and Betty Ballantyne and Judy mm-hmm. Merrill and whoever else from that era as editor, very important editors and publishers. But coming on right up to the present day, where overwhelmingly many, 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 many of the most important editors in the field are women, particularly book editors are female. I would suggest to you the ratio of women to men in editing is higher than the ratio of women to men in writing.
That could be, and that could partly have to do with the structure of publishing over the years. And you could end up, as C.L. Goldsmith did for you. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to Weird Tales.
Yeah.
You have women editors going back that far. You had what I think is an important figure in the late 1940s was a woman named Mary Nadinger, who edited Famous Fantastic Mysteries, reprint pulp magazines that basically introduced the works of A. Merritt and H. Rider Haggard and all kinds of earlier writers to a new generation.
Yeah.
But if you look at the histories, I picked this up probably, and if I'm wrong about it, he can correct me, but Mike Ashley's wonderful history of the science fiction magazines mm-hmm. suggests that a lot of women ended up in these positions simply by default. C.L. Goldsmith was assisting Howard Brown. He went on to do something else. And to some extent, the idea of an assistant editor or a minor editor was such a unpretentious, unprestigious job that you could hand it off to a woman who had been an assistant editor, who had been basically one of them. I can't remember who was actually a secretary when she became an editor.
Yeah.
So there was a sense that women could advance in the field because editing magazines didn't pay very well, didn't have any prestige, and by and large, most of the readers didn't even know who you were. So in a sexist culture like that, in a perverse way, women got opportunities that they may not have gotten in other ways. The exception at that in the 50s being Betty Ballantyne, who I have enormous respect for. I spent a lot of time with her at a mm-hmm. World Fantasy, and it became fairly clear to me that Ian ran the business, but Betty did the editorial work. And
yeah.
Betty assisted, as she said, very carefully reminded me, assisted by Fred Pohl.
Yeah.
But she did as much to shape what we think of as Ballantyne books and the whole Ballantyne tradition as any more than anybody, I would say.
Yeah. And do you think that's one of the great underappreciated contributions to science fiction?
Absolutely. I think the year's best, let's look at the year's best, which is something that you're doing now.
Yeah, yeah.
Interestingly enough, none of the year's best now, except for Ellen Datlow's and Paula Guerin's, are edited by women.
But, so it's now that's horror, basically, in fact.
Well, it's basically horror, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And we should not underestimate Ellen and Terry.
No, I don't. Not at all. I mean, Ellen's a fantastic editor of science fiction, fantasy, and horror.
And they're also very good editors of original fiction.
Oh, yes. Overwhelmingly.
But my point is that in terms of the idea of a year's best annual for science fiction and fantasy, it kicked around for a couple of years with volumes edited by Dicte and Blyler.
Yep.
And I think it started in 1949. And I don't know, those volumes, they got reviewed in the New York Times, but they didn't seem to make any historical impact. They didn't seem to kick around for very long, if they ever had paperback editions, I don't know. But when Judy Merrill started her annuals, suddenly it became news. Suddenly she began to deliberately and very consciously shape the field. And she was making arguments in 1956 and 57 that could have been made last year. She was making arguments that you could take stories from The New Yorker, you could take cartoons by Walt Kelly. She was making a very conscious argument that science fiction and fantasy is a mode of writing that exists outside the genre magazines. And she was criticized for it at the time. Now, we're sort of celebrating that attitude 50 years later. And she unfortunately, she doesn't get to see it.
Well, yes. That is unfortunate.
But yeah, to get back to current editors, the field of what we consider of literary horror, and literary horror is a figure, it's a phrase you can argue with, but it's one that Peter Straub has used, and it's one that I've heard Laird Barron use, so I think it's legit. I think literary horror as a short form has been completely shaped by Ellen Datlow over the last 20 years.
Sure. And what about Alice Turner? Did she have a role in that as the editor of Playboy? Isn't she the other one, I think?
I think that's a good point as well. I mean, Alice Turner knew the field inside and out. She knew a lot of the writers. She was close to Tom Dish. She was, and she was in a position, as relatively few editors have been. The only comparable position would have been Ellen again at Omni.
Yeah.
To present science fiction and fantasy and horror stories to a much broader audience than would otherwise have seen them.
Sure.
And that's not common today. I mean, it's, again, one of those things where you sound like an old fart if you start saying it. But but you talk to any writer of that era, and the fact that you could sell a story to Playboy with that kind of circulation for that kind of money is just the best. People wanted to do that more than to get into the New Yorker.
Yes. There's something which sort of bounces off this. It doesn't really talk to the most influential women. And I mean, there are other people I would throw in. I think Octavia Butler has proven to be incredibly influential in the modern era. James Tiptree is an interesting case because brilliant writer, brilliant short story writer, highly influential, though at different times, I think. I think there's a period where the Tiptree flame looked like it was sort of dimming for some years after her death, but has now very much come back to the fore.
That Julie Phillips's biography has a lot to do with that. I mean, Tiptree was a bit of science fiction folklore and is now a genuine legend in documented ways thanks to Julie's autobiography.
I don't think we should also have to say, in fairness, because of the Tiptree Awards itself bearing her name and the efforts of the convention that go with it, WISCON.
Well, I think the secret feminist cabal, I think the whole movement of WISCON from into the area of gender. I mean, I'm going to be on, I am on, I guess, currently. I guess this is okay to, I hope it's public knowledge, it is now. But I'm on the Tiptree jury for next year.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to look at the history of that award because WISCON is deservedly and avowedly the world's leading feminist science fiction convention, but the Tiptree Award is not an award for feminist science fiction. It's an award for science fiction that causes us to reconsider or evaluate or consider different approaches to the issue of gender. And it has. So you know, its winners, I think, have included Joe Haldeman and John Kessel, as well as Jeff Ryman and any number of other, Andrea Hairston, the current year. So it certainly has changed the dialogue of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the few conventions that's actually done that.
Yes.
When you think about it, can conventions actually make a difference? I think you can. I think you can make an argument, in the States at least, that ReaderCon has promoted literary fiction throughout across various genre boundaries, science fiction, fantasy, horror, mm-hmm. whatever. Some hard science fiction writers feel comfortable there. Literary horror writers feel comfortable there. Fantasy writers, John Crowley, however you want to categorize him, is very comfortable there. And I think it's done a lot to promote simply good writing across genres.
Yeah.
Is there anything in Australia that's had a kind of, you think, an ideological shift, helped make an ideological shift in the genre there?
In terms of gender or just generally? Gary?
Really?
I'm asking, I said in terms of gender or just generally?
Oh, just generally. I mean, what I was saying about ReaderCon is not specifically oriented to gender. What I said about WISCON is...
I don't think conventions have that sort of effect here, though it's interesting in terms of activity rather than philosophy, the impact that the Worldcons, the four Melbourne Worldcons have had. They've fundamentally affected how the genre works here. And there have been publishing changes based around individuals. I would say it feels as though there's been a change philosophically in the last 3 to 5 years on the subject of gender here. I think there's much greater gender awareness in the field and the discussion of it, just generally, but also here. And that, without a doubt, focuses around Galactic Suburbia and the stuff that they're doing. I think they've read.
That was going to be my next question. I'm glad you mentioned that, because do you think that podcasts have begun to replace the ideological influence of conventions in terms of the dialogue?
No, I don't. I think they have become, to my mind, a podcast is quite similar to the same communication mechanism that fanzines have occupied. It's part of the dialogue of the field. It's fans, readers, everybody else talking to each other, writers, whatever. So it's a very active, immediate kind of a dialogue. And so you give this chance to hear interested and passionate people talking directly. Yes, I guess it supplements. I mean, just as fanzine. I mean, I don't know if once upon a time, conventions supplemented fanzines, now fanzines supplement conventions or something. So I'm not quite sure. I haven't really thought through where the balance in those two things is. But certainly, I mean, I was asked to consider this one question. What changes have you seen in the Australian science fiction field since the Melbourne 2010 Worldcon? And I thought, well, to me, podcasts are the greatest change, because 2 years ago, there were very, very few podcasts. There's a film podcast here or there, one or two things. Now there's a lot of science fiction podcasts, particularly coming out of Australia. I mean, ours gets credited as an Australian podcast, though it's only 50-50. Obviously, Galactic Suburbia, obviously The Writer and The Critic. And there's a group of others, but they're the ones that come to mind immediately. And I think particularly Galactic Suburbia, contribute to the dialogue mostly probably by getting to be the Waldorf and Statler of Australian science fiction and talking about older things and bringing that perspective. I think Writer and the Critic are the ReaderCon of Australian science fiction, if you like. They're actually talking materially about books and texts and all that sort of thing. And then you've got Galactic Suburbia, which has a clear political agenda as part of what it does. And that has influenced the conversation, the dialogue. It's impacted on conventions. It's impacted on whatever else.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly has. I admire these fellow podcasts as much as you do. But The Writer and the Critic gets to be ReaderCon, and Galactic Suburbia gets to be WISCON, and we get to be the Muppets.
Sorry, dude. That's just the way the shit comes down sometimes.
Okay, we'll live with that, I guess.
Well, what do you want? We're rambling, Gary. If you want a planet, which one would you want to be? Are we the ICFA of science fiction? Are we?
Oh, don't even go there.
Well, what's your choice? Come on. If we're gonna give them, or did you want to be ReaderCon?
I don't want to be ReaderCon.
You did. You totally wanted to be ReaderCon, didn't you?
No. I'm warming to the idea of Statler and Waldorf. Okay.
Yes.
Let's focus then.
There's
something we can focus on this week. We can actually focus on something.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of starting off focused and then rambling, let's start off rambling and then focus. What do you think about the Campbell Award nominations?
Gee, there's a lot of guys on that list. That's my first, honestly. I looked at the list, and my first thought was that Kathleen Goonan's This Shared Dream was on it, and that it was an under-discussed book last year,
and I was
delighted to see it. My second thought was 11 nominees is a lot, and there's only two women on that list, and that's exactly that thought grows out of the discussions with Galactic Suburbia, without a doubt. But I said, you know, that makes me stop and go, well, hang on, were there really only two science fiction novels? And I realize this is a science fiction novel list. And that's something to bear in mind very clearly. But science fiction novel list, we could only find two women? Like, really? I mean, is that really true? Does that really reflect your reading from last year or my reading from last year? Because I bet that it doesn't. Next thought. Real presence on that list of 11 of non-major publishing houses books. There's, I think, three novels from Nightshade, for example.
Right.
Two of which are first novels, which is terrific. There's more first. There's one from PS Publishing, right. Lavi Tidhar's very interesting Osama, which is just sold to Solaris, I think it is. I think it was Solaris. And we'll get a broader audience now that gets that. There's a group of books, and I realize I'm rattling through my responses, not giving you a chance to discuss them.
No, go ahead.
I also couldn't help but note there are books which were under-discussed in 2011 on this list, and I think that's a good thing. Now, The Shared Dream is an obvious one. I think The Islanders is a book which, particularly in the United States, is yet to have had any broad discussion, so seeing that in the frame is very good. Dancing with Bears is a terrific, interesting book from Michael Swanwick, and yet didn't seem to generate a lot of discussion, so I'm happy to see that there. I'm delighted to see Gene Wolfe in the frame as well. Because Home Fires is another book that really just did not get discussed. I don't know if we just automatically assume that Gene is fantastic and then move along, but that was really encouraging. So, I mean, like, it's diverse. I mean, there's one or two books that I sit there and I do go, they wouldn't be on my list. But then I've become very relaxed about that when I see lists now. I don't know that I would have, I'm not particularly interested in Ready Player One or in Seed. They don't particularly resonate with me. The rest of the books, you know, I think they are good. Some of them are more flawed than others. But, yeah, the main thing is I keep sitting there going, really? Only two women? Really? Out of 11 books? That strikes me as curious, particularly when read in light of, say, our own Locus Award ballot, and when read in light of the Science Fiction Hall of Fame announcements recently, you know.
How are the finalists determined with the Campbell Awards? I ought to know that, but I don't pay enough attention to awards processes.
I think there's a jury, is my recollection, on the Campbell Award. And I think they get recommendations from around the field. They review the books that are sent to them, and then it's all done internally. But I think books have to be submitted, and then they're considered. Here we go. The Campbell Award is selected by a committee small enough to discuss the books themselves. The jury is Greg Benford, Paul DiFilippo, Sheila Finch, James Gunn, Betty Ann Hull, Paul Kincaid, Christopher McKittrick, Pam Sargent, and Tom Shippey. I think this is what it was saying.
Really?
At the document I'm looking at. This may be out of date, but that's what it's saying.
I think it's out of date.
Well, this is on the current...
The
current website for the Campbell Awards, so I'm going to go wild and say that might be current. And what happens is that they get nominations from science fiction publishers, and books are submitted to them. They read and consider them.
And their remit is only science fiction. They don't want to consider fantasy.
To be really tedious for 10 seconds or for a minute and a half, the winners of the award are Beyond Apollo by Barry Malzberg, Rendezvous with Rama by Clark, Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said by Dick, The Year of the Quiet Sun by Tucker, Kingsley Amis for The Alteration, Paul's Gateway, Moorcock's Gloriana, Dishes on Wings of Song, lots of guys, Gary, Benford's Timescape, Hoban's Ridley Walker, Aldous's Heliconia, Gene Wolfe's Citadel of the Autarch, Pohl's Year of the City, Brin's The Postman. I hated that book a lot. Slonczewski's Dorita. Oh, I hate it. That was a terrible book.
The one thing I can say about The Postman as a novel is that it's better than the movie.
Well, that is true. It was a rotten... I think it took the Clark... the book was first presented in 73. It was the first year that it was... It took till 1987 for a woman to win the Campbell, and it went to Joan Slonczewski for Door into Ocean, and then immediately followed up by Connie Willis for her debut Lincoln's Dreams. Bruce Sterling won for Islands in the Net, Jeff Ryman for The Child Garden, spectacular book, one of my favorites of all time. Pacific Age by Stan Robinson, another one of my all-time favorites. And then Brad Denton's Buddy Holly is Alive and Well on Ganymede, also brilliant, but really always back to the guys. Brotherhood of Dragons, weirdly in 94, this is preposterous, Gary. This award is preposterous. I mean, I like it, but how's this? 1994, the shortlist was at number 3, Moving Mars by Greg Bear, winner, I believe, of the Nebula Award, wasn't it?
Yes, I believe it was.
Nancy Kress's Beggar in Spain came in at number 2.
Holy cow.
Yep. Which I think won a Hugo, certainly parts of one Hugo's or Nebula's. And then no award at number 1. And you're going, no, get out of town. Just get out of town. What are you talking about? That's absurd. Beggars in Spain couldn't win the award? That's offensive, Gary.
That's bizarre. I agree. We don't know who to blame for that. We don't necessarily know who. Beggars in Spain. It's interesting. If you were going to name current living writers who have written maybe one or two classic novels. Now, in Nancy Kress's case, there are a lot of stories.
Yeah.
But I think most people, when they hear the name Nancy Kress, think Beggars in Spain is one of the identifiable classics of that decade.
Yeah. 95 was Permutation City by Egan. Then Baxter's The Time Ships, Macaulay's Fairyland, Haldeman's Forever's Peace, Zabrowski's Brute Orbits, Vinge's Deepness in the Sky, Anderson's Genesis, frankly, I think, yeah, being kind, Williamson's Terraforming Earth, and Wilson's The Chronoliths in 2002. Nancy Kress, they say sorry to in 2003 by giving her the award for Probability Space, a worthy win, but still... I still don't understand the other one. Omega by McDevitt wins in 04. Market Forces by Morgan in 05. Mind Scan by Sawyer in 06. Bova's Titan, we're now well established. This is an old farts award in 07 by Bova. Then Kathy Goonan for In Wartimes, which is a really interesting and good book.
That's really an odd choice in that list.
Yeah, I know. Stands out. But then the top three that year in 2008, The Execution Channel by MacLeod, The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Chabon, and Kathy's In Wartime. So that's just a strange, strange, strange list. Some great books. But and then they followed up the next year in 2009 with a tie between MacLeod's Song of Time and Doctorow's Little Brother. 2010, The Inevitable, Paolo Bacigalupi with The Wind-Up Girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, Ian MacDonald won for The Dervish House, which is a fantastic book that I love and adore and was a completely worthy winner. But I have to say, gee, that's just an awful lot of men. This is like a really blokey old guy award, isn't it?
It sounds to me like it's a Defending the Perimeter award.
You're kinder than me, okay.
Well, the kind of science fiction that, you know, that we know as science fiction is there. And there's a fair amount of that as well on the latest list.
Sure. But
you're looking at lists of winners compared to lists of nominees. We don't know who's going to win this year.
True. Well, hang on. I have the. I mean, they list them all. I mean, depending how far back you go. I mean, the year that Nancy won for Probability Space, like 2003, there was 10 books, 2 women.
Okay, so this is a pattern.
Oh, this is, on you know, it's in 2004, there's 16 nominees, and probably 4 of them were women. In 2005, there are 13, and probably 3 women. So this is them. This is a, to put it in the rather blunt words of some friends of mine, a bit of a cock forest. Gary?
Looks like it exactly. And there are some odd things here as well that strike me as being... Well, I mean...
Yeah, no, please.
I was looking at the current list again, and the things that make me feel good about the list are, you mentioned Kathy's novel.
Yep.
Will McIntosh's Soft Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. Dancing with Bears, Osama, but the ones that really strike me as ones that I was hoping to see some discussion about would be Kathy's novel, because that's the second novel in a duology, which I think is a terrifically intelligent pair of books.
Yes, and both of them,
as you know, I gave terrific reviews to both of them, and one of the most frustrating things you can do as a reviewer, I will say this, is you get enthusiastic about a book, I mean, and then you never hear about it. Nobody talks about it. You don't see very many other reviews of it. And you think you can't get a discussion started. And this shared dream is, if anything, a more complex view of alternate history than the first one was.
Yeah, this is the follow-up to In Wartimes, isn't it?
It's a follow-up to In Wartimes.
Which won in 2008.
as they used to say, complexifies in war times quite a bit.
Yeah.
And she's just a terrific writer who has, for some reason, not generated the buzz over the years that I think she should have. I mean, she did with the nanotech series, the, mm-hmm. the Queen City Jazz and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think one of the questions there is that there is a utopian edge to her writing, like there's a utopian edge to Stan Robinson's writing, that may just be out of favor right now.
Yeah.
The Christopher Priest thing, I like that a lot. A lot of people were complaining about it. Now people are sort of coming around to my point of view. I like to think that it's a really good novel.
Yeah.
And Osama, I understand why Osama didn't get a lot of discussion, although there was some, there was certainly Christopher Priest's argument in terms of the British Science Fiction, the Clark Award, that it should have been considered because it was available in England.
Mm-hmm.
But still, it was one of the more inventive, not alternate histories, but, histories within histories kind of yep. thing. It was interesting. And it was a hard-boiled novel and that sort of thing. It should have gotten a lot more attention than it did, and maybe it will now that it's getting a wider distribution than PS can give it. On the other hand, I did start Robopocalypse. And I got about as far page-wise into Robopocalypse the novel as I did letter-wise into Robopocalypse the word.
Fair enough. I'm going to ask you a controversial question, and I mean it to be controversial. Is the one of the reasons for the Campbell as a pure science fiction award being so male-heavy the fact that more men write science fiction? I'm not sure I'm convinced by this at all, but I'm looking at the locust long, long, long list, which... I mean, I know that, for example, the top five... finalists for the Locus Awards in science fiction, as opposed to fantasy or first novel or anything else, are men, right? I mean, because it's, I think, the top five for the Locus Awards were Leviathan Wakes, 2011 63, NBC Town Rule 34, and Children of the Sky, which are all by guys, compared to fantasy, which is what, two out of five females, and then you go to first novel, where there are three out of five, and of those, probably only one is science fiction or two are science fiction. And when you go on to the YA category, you know, again, there's plenty of women there, but mm-hmm. they're mostly not science fiction. And when I look at the long list of Locus nominees, you know, sort of, there's what, Elizabeth Baer's Grail, Mira Grant's Deadline, Katarina Sidia's Heart of Iron, Kathy Goonan's book, Kim mm-hmm. Westwood's The Courier's New Bicycle, there's C.J. Cherry's Betrayer, but, you know, sort of, there's not as many, obviously, you know. And so is that possibly a factor? Are we being unfair because there are less fish in the barrel? Or is it a flaw with the barrel? Or is it a flaw with the net?
I'm not sure. I think it, to some extent, does come down to what you think of as science fiction yeah. or what you think of as fantasy or what you think of. I mean, one of the books that is not on the Campbell Award list, presumably because it's not a science fiction novel, is Among Others, which you and I thought was one of the
yes.
one of the best novels of the year.
Yes.
And certainly is a novel about reading science fiction. It's a novel which is as relevant to the experience of science fiction as any novel published last year.
Yes.
But the action in the novel is fantastic in a fantasy sense, so it gets limited. So I would say if you're going to construct what I used to think of as the what they call about constitutional scholars constructivists, people who believe that the Constitution as written, as constructed, is all you can deal with, that's constructivist science fiction people who want to preserve a particular view of what science fiction is and can do, are going to end up with, by and large, a list of books mostly by men, because I think that when you look at a writer like Joel Walton, or you look at a writer, like even a writer like Cameron Hurley is clearly a science fiction writer, there's this edge of not really caring much if you know, sort of create a fantasy environment or something that looks like a fantasy environment while you're doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that the classic women-hard science fiction writers, of whom the most active now this year, thanks to her new novel, might be Joan Slonczewski, which includes people like C.J. Cherry, have always been fairly rare in the field.
Okay. I must say, I'm just looking back at stuff, and I'm surprised that Gwyneth Jones and C.J. Cherry have never been up for the Campbell.
That's rather surprising. And Gwyneth Jones has had a substantial body of work. And
oh, no, she was once. Cherry was once.
Okay.
For Hammerfall, of all books, actually.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, that sounds terrible to say, of all books, but it's not her most memorable book. So.
Yeah, I don't think... I just would not want to put myself in the position of saying that women don't write hard science fiction, because that's patently false, but...
It is patently false.
But in a given year, how many titles of what you would call hard science fiction are written by women?
And hang on, this award is not for hard science fiction, it's for science fiction. Or are you going to tell me that The Island is hard science fiction, or Dancing with Bears is hard science fiction, or That's Osama true. Is hard science fiction, or Zero History was, or Dervish House, or Blackout All Clear, or Galileo's Dream, or The City in the City? I mean, there are many, many nominees that are science fiction, and unequivocally science fiction, but without getting into the filtration method of identifying types of science fiction, which wasn't really what I was going to say about it, but anyway.
I like that filtration
method. without trying to separate out the types, I mean, there's a diverse range of types of science fiction in any year, and yet somehow they're just not by women. And either we're saying women aren't... this award is saying that, I mean, particularly if you put out a 16 book shortlist, right, you are saying women aren't writing any good science fiction if the best you can do is come up with two on a list. Aren't you?
You seem to be saying that seems to imply that. I would tend to agree.
You know, I mean, in 2008, 4 out of 14 books are by women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a high number for this award. I really think there's sort of something weird about it. If I ran off, I'm sure, and I ran the Hugo numbers, they have similar problems historically, and I'm sure the Nebulas have, and I'm sure every single award has. But this one seems to be carrying it, and just, I guess it stands out when there's 11 nominees on a list. And maybe it's something I should sort of let go and talk about a different subject to do with this, because there are many things, as we've said, to commend about it, but this is what stands out. I'm surprised that more people aren't kind of... I guess it's only just been released, but I'm surprised more people aren't going, oh my goodness, what happened?
It could very well be. I mean, it could be that this is what they looked at. It's funny because when you and I were talking last week, I believe, about the Locus Award nominations, and it became pretty clear that the hot name this year in terms of the Locus Awards is Kat Valenti.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that she's all over it. But you know, basically, one of those stories that she's got on the ballot is a science fiction story.
True.
She's somebody who's clearly experimenting with the field. The most exciting book I got in the mail today, which is not coming out until August, is the Small Beer Collection of Kidge Johnson short fiction.
Sure, sure.
There's an argument that in short fiction right now, she and Kat Valenti may be the two hottest writers in the field. But when you look only at novels, you're going to not be seeing what's going on the ground in the magazines and the anthologies and the best of the year anthologies and so forth.
Sure, sure. And I mean, I'll say as well that the companion award to the Campbell, which is the Sturgeon, is put out by the same group of people, and I would imagine the Sturgeon list can't be very far away, has a much better history of gender balance, I think.
I would hope so. I would think so.
Or somewhat better, anyway. I don't know. I'm gonna let this one rest. I'll let other people run with it for now. But I'll be watching in next year with interest, not with any kind of great militant purpose. But I'll be watching a little next year to see if that changes, and I hope it does broaden out, because I don't think it's reflecting excellence and achievement in the field.
I think it's certainly not reflecting all the excellence and achievement in the field. I mean, I would not want necessarily to. Well, yeah, I would. To condemn any of the novels that are on the
Campbell. No. Well, okay, you might have... You've actually picked one out, right?
Well, there's one that I don't...
You've named names. That I thought,
Robo-Apocalypse was silly. I would rather go see...
You'd rather go see the Avengers, right? Yep.
The Avengers was terrific.
Of course it was.
Avengers was... we can talk about... You know, here's a question. Is the Avengers... Are things like that... I mean, I've seen Iron Man, and I've seen... the Ang Lee Hulk movie, which is a very strange idea. But are superhero movies science fiction, or are they fantasy?
I think they're fantasy, but they can be science fictional, if that makes sense.
It makes about as much sense as you can expect. My argument is this.
Yep.
What I liked about the Avengers, which yes. I think is the best, I will defend this, although there were some issues with the role of Scarlett Johansson and that sort of thing, that is, was to me the most enjoyable superhero movie I've seen, partly because it knows it's a comic book and it does entertaining things that comic books do when you read them as kids. In other words, the Marvel Universe or the comic book universe isn't science fictional or fantasy in the literary genre sense. It's its own thing. It's its own thing, which means that you can have Loki, for example, who in literature shows up in there are Philip Jose Farmer novels with Loki in them. Obviously, Neil Gaiman's American Gods has Loki on it. It's clearly something that belongs in fantasy and literature.
Yes.
In the comic book world, you can have Loki as an alien from the planet Asgard, which makes no sense whatsoever, either mythologically or science fictionally. No. But in the world of Marvel Comics, in the world of this mythology, it works fine. If you look at Iron Man as a science fiction creation, it doesn't work. There isn't any way you can science fictionally explain the energy source on that, or even the...
Oh, no, That's all hand-wavium. Of the purest stripe, which is a fundamental part of all, a fundamental part of many comics, particularly these kind of Golden Age comics. But they're not really about that, are they? I mean, they're not about how Iron Man finds his power. Well, sorry. They're about how Iron Man finds his power source, not whether his power source makes any legitimate sense at all.
No, or even the physics of his little rockets in the holes.
I know.
But my point is this. My point is that we like these things, I think. I think one of the reasons that science fiction and fantasy fans are attracted to fairly good superhero movies, not all of them, is that they basically take all of the cards of science fiction and fantasy and some of the cards of horror and some of the cards that they just invent on their own and throw them in the air and say, we have a universe here in which whatever we want, whatever we need to have happen can happen.
Sure. And so the thing that they focus on as well is they focus on delivering the kind of emotional payoff you want. One of the examples, I mean, you said this is one of the most satisfying superhero movies we've ever seen. But there's a couple that I've enjoyed over the years that come to mind. There's a couple of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies that were very good. And the first Iron Man movie I thought was very good as well. There's a moment in one of the Spider-Man films where Tobey Maguire has really just got going as Spider-Man, and he's swinging down the middle of some street in Gotham or wherever it is. Mm-hmm. You know, his web's going, and he's just having fun. He's whooping with joy, right? And I think that is one of those fundamental like emotional moments that you identify with. Yeah, if you had that security and you could do that, that just looks like fun, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you respond to in these things as much as anything. Similarly, you know, sort of, if you're going to have a fight, don't you want to be sort of Iron Man rather than yourself? You want to be that, you got to hit something, there's an enormous amount of destruction rather than just a sore hand.
Well, absolutely. And if you're really, really angry, you want to be the Hulk. And that's what I think is the appeal of these things. But the mechanisms that they use to get these sort of primal emotional expressions on film are borrowed completely from science fiction mythology and fantasy, and somehow we don't object to that. I mean, I don't think I've seen anybody, and it would have to be somebody far geekier than even the people I run into at science fiction conventions, to argue that, the astronomy doesn't work out. How does that black hole thing, how does that dimensional hole open in the sky? Nobody in the science fiction world seems to worry about that. Nobody in the fantasy world seems to worry about the notion that they're taking Loki and Thor and completely twisting them to their own ends. Of course they're doing that, because they can.
Yeah.
Which means that these movies are about having fun. And why I like the Avengers and I like the Iron Man movies is there is a sense that we are having fun with this. And one of the things that begins to bother me with the later Superman movies and some of the Batman movies is when they start taking themselves seriously and get angst-ridden.
Well, I don't know.
Existentialist fables.
Nah, I'm not going to completely buy into that. I mean, I am a late arriver at a lot of comics, Gary, because I've been doing other things, haven't been particularly interested, whatever else. I started reading as I've said here before, when I bought my iPad last year, I started reading some comics on the iPad. Mm-hmm. And I read The Dark Knight late last year, which forms the basis, I think, for the third of the Christopher Nolan Batman films that's due out soon, The Dark Knight Rising, or Rises, or whatever it is. Yeah. And, I mean, yes, that's an angst-ridden story. It's all about there's Batman grown old and retiring and what it means. And, you know what? It's terrific. It's really good. I think there is a place for angsty, mature stories in these kind of environments. Yes, we want the whooping joy and exuberance and extracting it in some ways, that emotional hit high and hit from a logical framework. But there's also a place for the other thing. Otherwise, there's no place for a lot of the best work that's happening in comics and graphic novels around us. I think we have to allow this a spectrum.
Mm-hmm. No, I stand corrected to that extent, because I admire Alan Moore and certainly Neil Gaiman and Frank Miller as much. And that's it. I guess in my mind, because of having grown up with comic books as comic books, I'd make a kind of distinction between what I think of as a graphic novel and what I think of as a comic. And I don't think of The Hulk as a graphic novel.
Yeah.
Batman is interesting because he seems to have been... have begun in the broadly commercial comics industry and moved into the graphic novel field, which maybe permits a great deal of depth for that sort of thing. But certainly you're right. The narrative complexity in Sandman, which I probably read more of than any single series, is astonishing. I mean, it is as literarily complex as any work of fiction published during that period.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why it's, interestingly enough, not likely, I don't think, I hope not, to make a 2.5-hour movie very soon, because it's, I don't see how you could do that out of that massive material.
Yeah. We're almost done, Gary.
We are.
I have one last, oh my God, are they all old sexist people question for you, though.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want your perspective on this, because I'm curious. I had an interaction with our friend and sometime co-presenter, guest podcasty person, Tansy Roberts, because I was listening to the most recent Galactic Suburbia, and they were talking about the Hall of Fame, and they were talking about, they mentioned Virgil Finlay, who's just been admitted to the Hall of Fame, deservedly in many ways, for a major achievement in the field. And she was going like, who's he? I've never heard of him.
Oh dear.
Well, no, not oh dear. It's fair enough. I mean, honestly, what if his work is available today? He's not widely known any longer, I don't think, really, outside certain parts of the field. And I said, well, he was a brief little comment on it. And she said, well, what about Margaret Brundage?
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's got a heck of a point. You know, why not Margaret Brundage? Isn't this that the same kind of achievement or not? Do you think I'm off?
Yeah, I think the argument there is that Margaret Brundage essentially did Weird Tales covers in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, also partakes of this fairly narrow range of what we think of as science fiction.
Yeah.
Virgil Finlay did a lot of fantasy art. He did a lot of science fiction art. There are a lot of famous stories that he wrote that he did illustrations for, such as Philip Jose Farmer's The Lovers. He was all over the science fiction pulp magazines. Margaret Brundage was, as far as I can tell, and there's an interesting essay on Margaret Brundage by Margaret Atwood, of all people, in her book.
Really? Yes, there is.
There's an appreciation of her, yeah. And Margaret Brundage was a very interesting painter, but she did Weird Tales covers that were almost exclusively horror stories and a few fantasy stories, and I'm not sure anything that could be considered science fiction by even a stretch.
Yeah. Could be. And Gary, just while you were saying that, I had an epiphany, which I will now share with you. Here's my epiphany. If Galactic Suburbia is WisCon, if the writer and the critic is ReaderCon, I know what we are, Gary.
Oh, don't tell me. I don't want to hear this.
We're the bar at every con, Gary.
We're the bar. Okay, there we go. I will completely agree with that, because one of the things that I learned at my favorite conventions... And by favorite conventions, I don't mean the ones that are always consistently good year after year, but I mean the ones that just turn out to be unexpectedly good. Sometimes I'll go to a Worldcon, which is always overcrowded and chaotic, but it'll turn out to be really good. It's because of the bar. If you've got a convention that has a good bar and you can settle in with it, and sooner or later you'll see everybody you want to see there, The bar at ReaderCon is as good as ReaderCon, as far as I'm concerned.
There you go. Well, with that, we'll call last call here in the Waldorf room, Gary. We'll put the chairs on top of the tables. We'll close the doors until next time when we talk again in episode 102. I look forward to talking to you then.
Okay, talk to you next week.
Okay, bye.